reporting. During the period of total instability between your loss of consciousness of the creator system and the arrival of the physician, he says, I will be surety for the integrity of your personality. And that the gesture any other outside help would have been superfluous. This is God's pleasure. Now, don't ask me how this is done. I don't know. He tells me never will know. But that to me explains the incarnation satisfactorily. When you get into the details, as the human mind of the human Jesus, in which lives Michael's personality, not a creature personality, a creator personality. At about the age of 12, he begins to have feelings that he's not quite like other men. There is a progressive revelation that takes place between Jesus' growing human mind and the divine mind of the Creator Son, with which he is making gradual contact. You follow me? When he's 15, praying out on a hill north of Nazareth, he confesses he doesn't know who he is. I just want to be sure, talking to his father, so I've always been subject to your will. I'm not quite sure who I am, what my relationship has been to you. I've always been subject to your will. You see, the human mind knows a little, but not enough. Enough to confuse it, but not enough to liberate it from confusion. This goes on and on and on. Throughout his early adult life, more and more, this human mind finds out who he is. Does he remember everything? Because he had written on permanent materials. When he went home, he burned all the boards. He had written the prayers on. He had remembered Gabriel's admonition. You see, that's what he was doing during the 40 days. He was getting, the human Jesus was getting acquainted with the other half of himself, the divine Mike, and figuring out what to do. Same thing happens to us. When in about the fifth dimension world, we fuse with our adjuster, there's a scene that takes place, which is its parallel in the Jordan at the time of Jesus' baptism. An archangel appears in our presence and says, this is he, beloved son, in whom I am well pleased. And we're excused. 40 days to go away and get acquainted with ourselves, because we have a new mind to get acquainted with. See, Jesus never had the thrilling experience of a just fusion. He had the unique experience of a human mind getting acquainted with a creator mind. Our experience is of a human mind getting acquainted with the mindedness of the indwelling spirit, the thought adjuster. The two episodes are analogous, but not homologous. And I dare say, we'll be all shook up, because all of a sudden, a kind of an iron curtain has gone down, and we get twice the living space we ever realized. We can move in a direction we never could move freely in before, although increasingly, has been communication as we near fusion. I dare say it is a jarring experience. So they tell us to go away. At that time, that time we're born. The incubation period is over. And for the first time, they give us a name. Right now, we're known by numbers. Part of the adjuster's number. Very literally, when we fuse. But in spirit, whenever you become a child of God, you're born again. Any place. Whenever you say, all right, boss, I'm one of your kids. You're my father. This is settled. Like yesterday, today, and tomorrow, dried apples and rainwater and stuff you throw out of the window fall. This is settled. Then your son. You should do something about it. Because all these other critters, huh? First you become a son. Then you look around. And you say, well, all these other animal people are his kids too. I should treat them that way. And you start living God's will. To me, the best definition of God's will is in the Great Commandment. You shall love the Lord your God. All your strength, all your heart, your soul, your neighbors, your soul. Now, that's a statement of principle. This is not a formula for action. Each person has to interpret that commandment to himself and for himself, and no one can do it for you. Those words mean something a little different to every human being. They'd have to.
I'm sure I had to get you.
Well, bless you all.
I'm sure going to know great.
Well, we don't know.
No, but
I but we can get.
Yeah.
Of course we are. You don't know where his personality was. It was with the divine mic.
You mentioned earlier, excuse me, still have manual. I just want to add a Bible.
I don't. It's only used a few times.
You mentioned
the sense
earlier about he found God, but does God help?
Of course he must.
Did he help in the sense he left himself wide open for the finder? Did he personally? Was it, I'm thinking about the predestination.
As far as I know, Bill, I did it strictly on my own.
He did leave himself wide open.
As far as I know, I could detect no help. But thinking back now, I'm not that sharp. Why, sure. I can't put my finger on it and say it was this or this or this. I can put my finger on a half a dozen very ordinary happenings which happened to fall in a sequence that got me to thinking like crazy. We broke this impact. not ship for game. Thank you, Goldie. We broke this impasse. Not as it pertains to total reality, but as it relates to deity. Does that sound familiar? That's exactly what happened in the Paradise Trinity was formed. You see, until we get God the Absolute, we cannot achieve the grand reassociation of everything. That would be the Trinity of Trinity. We can assemble the first level of the Trinity of Trinity. That's the three Trinities. Paradise, first and second experiential. But the second level is made up of the Supreme, the Ultimate, and some presence of the Absolute. At least we can split what now. With the trinitized expression of God the Absolute, which the Supreme and the Ultimate are able to make, this is a sub-infinite expression, which means that growth goes right on. Because this is not a total absolute here. If it were, then we would have exhausted infinity. And that's silly on the face. I think along with this transaction will come the invasion of the final area of space. And if space is growing, this is an endless invasion. We'll establish a beachhead on the shores of infinity and go on expanding indefinitely. You see, as long as God the Absolute is sub-infinite, then God the Absolute can continue to grow, and we can continue to participate in that growth. Are you with me? Level 8. Well, level 2 is potential. Level 8 I would call actualized potential. Level 8 we can't really achieve, because now we are talking about the exhaustion of capacity in the unqualified absolute. This is non-doable. If level 8 could be achieved, I think the universal absolute would functionally disappear, because you would have united the two absolutes experientially. This can be done on sub-infinite levels in the Supreme. This can be done on transcendental levels in the Ultimate. This cannot be done on infinite levels with the Absolute. I would suggest a differentiation between the word absolute and the word infinite. To me, the word absolute means quality. The word infinite means quantity. You can have an absolute in quality without involving infinity of quantity. In its way, a thought adjuster is absolute. What can you do about a fragment of God? The quality of divinity in the adjuster, I submit, is absolute, unattenuated, undiluted. Quantity-wise, though, this is not the first source that there is. Just a piece of it. God the Absolute can be a bona fide absolute reality, not being infinite in any way, shape, or form. When you experience God the Absolute, you're having an experience on an absolute level. We have the capacity to penetrate the absolute level. So they tell us, describing our personality. So the final dimension of human personality, capacity for sub-infinite penetration of the absolute level. I think at level 9, we go right on and on and on, actualizing potential, and there is no end. What's level 10? I'm sure my son of him is getting good marks for courage, if not for discretion.
Because you're toying with insincerity. You're failing to live up to what you know. And this, to me, is evil. If you know you're doing this, then you are disloyal to deity, aren't you? And the papers, in just one place, define sin. Well, the best definition I know is at the tail end of sin, sacrifice, and atonement. Page 984, the italicized sentence. Sin must be redefined as deliberate disloyalty to deity. There are degrees of disloyalty. The partial loyalty of indecision. The divided loyalty of confliction, the dying loyalty of indifference, and the death of loyalty exhibited in devotion to godless ideas. There is no real sin in the absence of conscious disloyalty to deity. You can feel guilty as all get out, but that doesn't mean that God feels guilty about it, knows that you're guilty or thinks you are. You can try to
define God as a
material ideal. Sure. Doesn't have to be evil, just godless. Well, what? There is a danger to a secularist. His entire life purpose is identified with the material and the temporal. He's not a bad man, but there is no place for God in his life. He has his religion either in his wife's name or the minister's name, or the priest's name. Yeah. And he just says, Reverend, you take care of this end, and I'll write a check every year and put something in substantial on the plate every Sunday. I don't think you buy a first class ticket to heaven. You gotta earn it. Remember what Jesus said when he said, those who do not acknowledge me in this life, I shall not acknowledge in the next life. And there are many who will cry, Lord, Lord, that I will not hear. We may get a revival meeting because,
but this was an answer that Billy Graham gave that the woman lost her husband and her feet had been taken from her. No, it's wrong that it was. And she said the doctor could not find anything wrong with her. And she said, when they had suggested, he suggested that she go back to church. And he said, now don't say, why should I go to church when I can't hear? Then he told someone, I don't know what was it anyway, it's for some of the subjects of work, it shows whose side you're on, but it's beginning to stop at work. And he got to his expenses, that was how I'm coming, so people could do something like that. And he didn't stop, and that's the time to go, because he was going to come back. But the same subjects of work, they were that outside, so many times, shows whose side you're on.
There are many ways of looking at sin, but from the universe philosophic viewpoint, sin is the attitude of a personality who is knowingly resisting cosmic reality. Error might be regarded as a misconception or distortion of reality, since we do not escape in this lifetime. Evil is a partial realization of or maladjustment to universe reality, since we do not escape. But sin is a purposeful resistance to divine reality, a conscious choosing to oppose spiritual progress, which we don't have to buy. While iniquity consists in an open and persistent defiance of recognized reality and signifies such a degree of personality disintegration as to border on cosmic insanity. Page 7:54, they're discussing Caligastri, the message is pertinent to Lucifer. Error suggests lack of intellectual keenness. Evil, deficiency of wisdom. Now look, these two things we've got to live with. Thing is, we aren't smart enough, we aren't wise enough. Error and evil will plague us all the days of our life. And it's a normal part of the stimulus to do good and seek truth. You reach out for the hot stove and you learn something about the vacuum of life. And it's a permanent. It's a permanent job. From then on, you stay away from hot stove. Sin suggests abject spiritual poverty, but iniquity is indicative of vanishing personality control. And when sin has been so many times chosen, and so often been repeated, it may become habitual. Habitual sinners can easily become iniquitous, become wholehearted rebels against the universe and all its divine reality. While all manner of sins may be forgiven, we doubt whether the established iniquitous would ever sincerely experience God for his mercy or accept forgiveness for his sin. This is the unpardonable sin. What's that? Oh yeah, I think Lucifer will be obliterated.
You don't think he has a change at heart?
The papers express a doubt. They just say he gets increasingly contemptuous and rejecting mercy.
Well, that's bad. But I thought he might be mistaken.
I think he's not. Personality can know what it is doing before it does it. Only personalities possess insight in advance of experience. A personality can look before it leaps, and can therefore learn from looking as well as from leaping. In other words, Caligastria has have the capacity to look ahead and see what he was getting into. This means he made a moral choice and is accountable for this choice. If he had lacked the ability to look ahead, his choice would not have been a moral choice, and it could not have been conscious disloyalty to deity. It's just being a damn fool, like a kid reaching out to touch a hot stove, and would have had no such repercussions in his personality. You see, when God gives you this power of choice, he also gives you an attribute that goes with it, moral prevision. And since you have this ability to look ahead, you can be held accountable for the choices that you make. Now, as I view choice, we've been over this before. Consider choice as it moves outward and material work. You have less and less to say. You're less and less accountable, morally and spiritually. Now consider choice as it moves inward and spiritward. You have greater and greater freedom, hence greater and greater accountability, until you finally get to the supreme inner choice, which is you in relation to God. And here, for the first time, there are no restrictions, no strings whatsoever. This is the one place where you can make an absolute choice, because this choice has significance in eternity. All other choices are limited to time. This is an eternal choice, hence an absolute choice. And there's nobody can push you. You can be inspired, you can be lost. But there's only one red button that applies to you, and it's your thumb that has to go down on that red button of decision. Which means each of us is strictly on his own. A personality can look before it leaps, and can therefore learn from looking, as well as from leaping. A non-personal animal ordinarily won't learn only by leaping. So animals cannot make moral choices, only experimental choices. Moral acts are those human performances which are characterized by the highest intelligence, directed by selective discrimination in the choice of superior ends, as well as in the selection of moral means to attain these ends. Such conduct is virtuous. Supreme virtue, then, is wholeheartedly to choose the will of the Father in heaven. Listen, folks, we've got equipment. And we're going to have to do certain things for ourselves. Isn't anybody going to do them for us? We can ask for all the help in the world and get it, spiritually, but we first have to ask. Even the thought adjuster can't do it or anything for you that you don't want done. It probably won't do for you many of the things that you do want done. You know, you both have to be in agreement. It has to be not only your desire, but also God's will. Then things happen. What the Son chooses and the Father wills is. If you don't choose it, he can't work. And if what you want isn't what he wants, he is not going to help you. But where you coincide, this is where things happen. And you know, if it was easy, would it be worthwhile?
No. How did you explain the problem?
I quoted scripture. Very helpful when you read the Bible. I said it's the true light that lighteth every man that cometh into the world. This will register. If I were talking to a Mohammedan, I would quote the Quran and say, men search So searching for me afar off, but I'm there doing his own jugular thing. This is a beautiful one. We better listen to the rest. You see, this is why I approach these papers with a long, long running start, getting into personality, evil, sin, iniquity, and now this prevision aspect of morality. If it weren't for that, you would say, gee, they're unfair to Caligari. He slipped once and he's a dead pigeon. But he had the capacity to look ahead and know exactly what he was doing. He didn't swing blind. He saw that pitch coming and deliberately swung and fouled out. It's fair, isn't it? I think it is. I think it's fair. And if I hadn't doubt, there's a couple of things that would comfort me. The statement, the flat statement the Divine Counselor makes concerning the nature of God. He just flatly states, God as a Father transcends God as a gift. And elsewhere they say, we do not claim to administer justice in absolute perfection out here in time and space, but we do claim to administer justice with mercy. And in case of a doubt, we always rule in favor of the creature. We would rather risk another Lucifer rebellion. We would cheerfully risk it rather than judge wrong on just one creature. I think I can find it all. I can be in several places for forgiveness. I can.
In other words, it's not the first thing they
No, your faith. Any question about the play, your thing?
No, it's like my voice. I never been rescued.
We had rather assume the risk of a system rebellion than the court the hazards of depriving one struggling person from any evolutionary world of the eternal desire for good and the endless career. If each creature presents a unique and irreplaceable value, there is no other personality like that one in the whole universe of universes. We can't replace it. The universe is not dependent on that creature, but that creature is an irreplaceable bed in eternity. So they're interested in getting as many, not in culling as few. Personality that the Father bestows remains as some value in the universe. If it doesn't survive, it's a part of the experiential nature of the Supreme Being. What's that? Yeah, and it could be the healing of that story in the Supreme Being. It goes to him if it doesn't survive. It remains a part of it. You see, hell, as portrayed in the Urantia book, is exactly the same as heaven in Hinayana Buddhism and Hinduism. The personality unites with deity as a drop of water unites with the ocean. That's the alternative to survive. But that's not you making your volitional contribution to the cosmos. The thought adjuster has transcripted everything of spiritual value in the life of such a non-offender. The Supreme Being has the personality received from God. I think it's probably indestructible. But it's not a person anymore. As an individual. I've wondered that, Bill. I have a strong feeling, if ever, not in this universe. But I have many times wondered, if never. I don't know. It's better that we not know. And I don't think the authors of these papers know, because I think if it had ever happened, they'd know it. And the fact that if they are silent on that point suggests to me it's never happened, at least yet. And if it's never happened yet, I'm pretty sure it won't happen in this universe. What it'll be like, I don't know. And there is no warrant for the speculation in the papers. There's no prohibition against it either. Yes, I've speculated along these lines. Those beings would miss one thing that's irreplaceable. They would never again participate in the growth of the Supreme Being. That is limited to the present universe age. Whatever their experience, it would be a post-supreme experience. I'm interested if you thought of that. For a long time, simply, his only reaction to Mike Gill's proffered mercy has been contempt. This seems to me to be what an iniquitous being would do. He's too proud. He isn't willing to become a physical custodian in the Lamanabek world, having risen so high. He is imprisoned by his own pride. He won't admit anything. When they say they play for keeps, well, let me ask you a question. If our speculation is right, and he is an iniquitous being, then from the paradise perspective, Lucifer is not real, is he? As it says, his extinction from the paradise perspective is simultaneous with his embracement of iniquity. You can have a time lag in a physical universe. For example, let's say that Monday in Dallas, I get hit by a taxi cab, and the net result is a severe brain injury, actual damage to the skull, the cortex. As a result of which, I'm going to be an idiot for the rest of my life. This means, as far as the universe is concerned, I died in that accident. They wind up my record. Thought adjuster goes to division. I'm dead on the universe record. My body, my physical body, might linger on, God forbid, as a vegetative sort of existence for any number of years. I wouldn't have any bad habits to shorten my life, and I might live interminably. So what it says is you don't drink, smoke, or kiss girls. You may not live to be 100 years of age, but it'll seem that way. All right, now, am I real or not? Just a question. I'm not real as a person anymore. I'm not a human being. But with society and a live body, I understand, right? I offer that as an approach to considering the reality of Lucifer. From a physical standpoint, I'm sure he's real. Because if we get there soon enough, we can go see him with our Mirage Sensorium. We can visit the Father's world and see the old geezer in the Hoos Gallery. From a paradise standpoint, I'm pretty sure he's not real. Now I'd like to ask you the $64 question. From Lucifer's standpoint, from the standpoint of his own internal consciousness, is he or isn't he real? And I don't know the answer to that. But I speculate.
What is his internal consciousness?
He is mine.
Mind.
He is mine. But is he real to himself?
I bet he is.
I don't know. I offer it to you as an interesting speculation. I have no answer to offer you, so I'm baffled with it. I'm sure from the paradise standpoint, he's not real. I'm sure that from the physical standpoint, he's just as real as my mindless body would be if I physically survived an accident or died in every other way. You could go see me, you know. You'd have to see me intravenously. I wouldn't know. Now, Lucifer is a little more complicated than that. I think he's insane. Yes. In terms of human psychology, I think both Lucifer and Caligastia have a queer mix of schizophrenia and paranoia. Now, paranoia is either, in its extreme form, either delusions of grandeur or delusions of persecution. I think Lucifer has delusions of grandeur. Schizophrenia is where you lose contact with reality and believe you're dreaming. I think Lucifer is in some sense schizoid as well as paranoid. Now, would you like me to attempt a psychological analysis of Lucifer?
No.
All right. I think Lucifer is a combination of two traits. I've got to humanize Lucifer to talk about him. Lucifer combines two traits which we find in human nature. If you get either of them alone, you can live with them. You put the two together, and you have a potential devil. And I'm going to shock you when I give you one of these traits. Trait number one is idealism. Trait number two is egoism. I think Lucifer started out as an idealist. He wanted to make things happen faster. That's what all idealists want to do. Let's have at it. This alone is not too bad. Peter came to Jesus after they had been in boot camp for only a few months and said, "Master, we'd be ready. Let's go take the kingdom." And Jesus chuckled and said, "In effect, Peter, I hope your zeal atones for your ignorance and your enthusiasm atones for your poor judgment." And Peter was crushed and got back and practiced squat right a little while longer. Peter was not an egotist, an egoist. If you are an idealist and you think you've got the right answer, and then you're an egoist, you know you're right. And by gollies, you'll have at it then, and nobody's going to stop you unless you get hurt and learn to. This is the combination, I think, that is dangerous. The two together. Jesus was no idealist. He was a very practical, bestowed son with high ideals. There's a great difference there. You see, the idealist believes his ideals will work here and now. Let me give you an example. This is past history enough so we can discuss it, I think, without being part of it. Have any of you ever read The Covenant of the League of Nations? You ought to read it sometime. It's not perfect. And yet we had a president who came back and treated it as though it was cut in stone tablets fresh from Mount Sinai. This was an idealist with entirely too much ego. And I regard Woodrow Wilson as one of the architects of World War II. No give, no compromise. Ideal plus ego.
You think he would have been Bill if his ego hadn't gotten in his way?
Oh, yes, it's been wonderful. If his ego hadn't gotten his way, he'd have sent Cabot Lodge over there to negotiate this. And the Republicans would have been committed, and we did in the league. And we might not have had another war. When you hit an idealist, you don't argue with him. You can't win. When the Japanese are in Burma, on the Indian frontier, and Mahatma Gandhi preaches non-resistance, Viceroy Lord Wavell has only one possible course of action. Put the sweet old guy in jail. Because if you debate the issue with Gandhi, you lose. Don't ever argue with an idealist. You might shock him. I'm a reasonably reformed idealist. I'm not an egoist. I feel humble about my ideals. I got lots of them. I'm not too sure they're right, though. There's a big difference. Let me give you a typical idealistic response to practicality. This happened years ago. Question of the organization of the Rancher Brotherhood came up. This is many years ago. I suppose I delivered the most impassioned, eloquent speech I ever delivered in my life about binding down the spirit of truth. Brian's Cross of Gold speech had nothing on that one. shackling truth once more with man-made rules, regulations, and so forth, we've gone down this garden path to disaster every time. And it was real good. I'm proud of the speech. I'm proud of the rhetoric, not of the thought. And my old man is a wise old boy when he stops to think. He's human, too. And he didn't try to interrupt that speech. It would have been like swinging a hurricane with a baseball. But afterwards, when our little meeting was over, he reached over and he said, "Son," he said, "a question I'd like to ask." "Well, that's an awfully good approach, you know. Somebody wants some information." He said, "You're a student of history." That's a statement of fact. He said, "Can you tell me the name of that religious movement which has persisted more than 100 years without an organization?" Well, I didn't reply at the moment, but I knew instantly. I knew instantly that this ideal ain't going to work in the 20th century. I never abandoned the ideal, but I don't espouse it anymore. You see, my ideal applies to Havona. Concerning the government of the central universe, there is none. I still have the ideal, but I'm going to wait till I get to Havana. Okay? Honestly, I'll get it someday, but not down here now. You get my point?" Probably. The Lucifer started an idealist. Unfortunately, he was an egoist. So that as he began to see his ideal get into trouble, he then fell back on his ego, his pride, and insisted he was right, and refused to admit he was wrong. He refused to learn from experience. And he's held to his ideal. He's reinforced them with his pride. He's laid his personality prerogatives on the line, and you can't cope with it. That's my analysis of a devil. If you combine real idealism and real egoism, you get potential trouble. And my counsel to you is, don't ever argue with an ideal. You'll lose every time. I'll put it to you this way. Should you take human life? Of course not. Well, suppose that you were the custodian, parental or otherwise, of small children, and some formidable-looking intruder breaks in, and you happen to know where there's armaments. Would you use force in defense of those children? It's a rough question, isn't it? I would. And if I was there, then I could never be a conscientious objector to that, even though I do not believe in what I'm doing. I'd still do it. I'd choose just as straight as the boys who believed in the righteousness of what they were doing. I would never believe in the inevitability of what I was doing. I would accept the 20th century. That's my ideas about Lucifer. Let's put it this way. Let's consider two other folks, not on our level. Let's consider Brother Abner and Brother Paul. Abner was a rigid idealist. And Abner had a good deal of warrant for denouncing Paul as the clever corrupter of the teachings of Jesus. And as you read the record, there's a lot of warrant in there. But what happened? I'll bet a cookie the angels of the churches loved Abner. But who did they work with? Paul. Mohammedanism is a monument to Abner's idealistic pig-headedness. Jesus never commissioned these people to preach monogamy or a lot of other social observance. He told them to preach God. Monogamy will come along in due course if people really believe in God. Abner probably put a lot of stringent social restrictions around this gospel. And the whole Eastern propaganda of the teachings of Jesus is an abysmal failure, isn't it? The papers are silent, pretty much, about Abner, aren't they? You can read about where he went down to Hebron and he spent a couple of weeks with Abner. But you will not find out what he talked about in this book. These people are very clever at seeming to tell you something when they're telling you nothing. There was just as much opportunity for the gospel going east as west. The timing of Jesus' teaching should have been about 100 A.D. in what's now Afghanistan, Pakistan. This is where Northern Buddhism was born. And this could have served as just as good a vehicle for the gospel in Asia as Judaism served for it in the Occident. But there was no one there. Abner was an idealist, and he failed. Paul was a practical organizer. Sometimes I think too practical. But anyway, he succeeded. At any rate, he got something going. He got something going. I'll give you another comparison. This is the classic comparison. Consider Moses and Akhenaten. Akhenaten was an idealist. Akhenaten was Pharaoh of Egypt at a time when Egypt was the best organized nation on the face of the earth, which means that its sovereign had more power than any other living human being at that time. Akhenaten was a monotheist, and he had the Egyptian Army, Navy, and Marine Corps behind him. You couldn't stand up in front of him. He could plow you under. And with all of his governmental authority, he set out in one generation to establish monotheism in Egypt. Did he succeed? No. The polytheistic priesthood went underground. When he died, they came topside and chiseled his name off the temple and reestablished polytheism. Moses was no idealist. He had ideals, but he was not an idealist. What did Moses have to work with? Well, he had a good Egyptian education himself. A corporal's guard and lieutenants were educated, and for the rest, he had a bunch of ignoramuses, ex-slaves, ex-serfs, a ragtag bunch of Bedouins to work with. Moses didn't try to go too fast. When Moses could not sell monotheism, he sold henotheism. When he couldn't get the boys to go along with there's only one God, he backtracked and said, who among the gods is like our God? You find that in Exodus. You find it in the book too. Moses didn't lead the congregation too far. They stayed with him. And he built so damn well that some of these teachings are a problem in the world today. But at least it's you better become a finaliter. You better be restricted in your choice as you're moving up the line. And I don't have to do anything more than to appeal to the human experience of children. You all feel the wisdom of that. Is it better that the child's choice be restricted, not stifled, but his is? Let's consider another problem. That's the part and the whole, which is first discussed in this paper on the universe of universes. It's in the philosophical tail end of this paper. And you'll recall that it sets up a paradox. God loves each child, and that brings into being the relationship of father and son to father, the realization of which constitutes survival. The acceptance of sonship is the price of human survival. But gee, he loves everybody that way. And now we encounter not the each relationship, but the all relationship. And this brings into being realities of the whole. There is not only a fatherhood of God making each of us his child, but there is a brotherhood of all beings. And this ties us all together like mountaineers going up a mountain. This is the great fraternal circuit, which is the inevitable corollary of the father-son relationship, right? Well, as goes the part, so goes the whole, and as goes the whole, so is the part affected. If we're going to be members of this divine family, then we act like together, aren't we? We, our joys, our sorrows, are not just a matter of our own experience, it is a matter of our fraternal relationship. If any one of us takes snuff, the others have an inclination to sneeze. If we are socially related, spiritually related, the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man represent the paradox of the part and the whole on the level of personality. God loves each individual as an individual child of the heavenly family. Yet God thus loves every individual. He is no respecter of persons, and the universality of his love brings into being a relationship of the whole, the universal brotherhood. This very love of God for the individual brings into being the divine family of all individuals, the universal brotherhood of the free will children of the Paradise Father. And this brotherhood, being universal, is a relationship of the whole. Brotherhood, when universal, discloses not the each relationship, but the all relationship. Brotherhood is a reality of the total, and therefore discloses qualities of the whole in contradistinction to qualities of the part. Brotherhood constitutes a fact of relationship between every personality in universal existence. No person can escape the benefits or the penalties that may come as a result of relationship to other persons. The part proffers or suffers in measure with the whole. The good effort of each man benefits all men. The error or evil of each man augments the tribulation of all men. As moves the part, so moves the whole. As the progress of the whole, so the progress of the part. The relative velocities of part and whole determine whether the part is retarded by the inertia of the whole or is carried forward by the momentum of the cosmic brotherhood. Going back to the Lucifer Rebellion, we encounter the problems of the part and the whole in relation to the ethics of coping with this rebellion. There are reasons for letting it run. In the first place, even justice wouldn't destroy it immediately. There's got to be a timeline for realization. Repentance. You're going to blot him out? How do you know that he's iniquitous? He might repent. I'm sure God knows, because he knows before the event. But the creatures of time and space do not know. And it's important that their feeling of justice be not outraged by apparently arbitrary acts of an all-knowing deity. Secondly, we have a mercantile way. Michael refused to destroy his own son until he tried. Even though Michael knew that all of his other sons were going to have to pay some of the price for his attitude of love toward his erring son. And how are you going to enjoy the benefits of the family of Michael in Nebadon without paying the prices which attach to family membership? When Michael was here on earth, he demonstrated that in his own family. One of his younger brothers was a real troublemaker, do you remember? Jude. And several times, James and Joseph wanted to throw Jude out on his you-know-what. But Jesus, somehow it's wrong to use the word plagiarism in that context, isn't it? Jesus just said, no. Be patient. He held the family together. Even though I'm sure some of Jude's carrying on were an embarrassment to the Nazareth family. Certainly, in Jude's wisecrack to the Roman legionary in Jerusalem wasn't exactly a happy episode in Jesus' life, because they spent the Passover in jail. The Roman soldier made a crack at a Jewish maiden, and Jude let him have it. The soldier arrested Jude. Jude wasn't confirmed that Passover. He and Jesus spent the Passover in jail. All right, you cannot have a loving father here in this lovely universe and expect this loving father to be actuated by cold justice when one of his sons makes trouble for the rest of the family. If he's that kind of a father, then he's not a loving father, is he? You see the paradox?
Is this the same Jude that
Yes, I think so. He got better after he got married. That tape was in here, too. Parents, those who have born and reared children, are better able to understand why Michael, a creator father, might be slow to condemn and destroy his own son. Jesus' story of the prodigal son well illustrates how a loving father can long wait for the repentance of an erring child. And then they take inventory of 14 reasons, as I recall. 12 reasons. For the wisdom of delay. Number one, how are you going to show mercy independent of time? You can't exhibit mercy instantaneously, can you? You've got to be patient to be merciful. And how can you have patience without time? And secondly, God as the Father transcends God as the Judge. They're not going to destroy anything which might be salvaged. They're slow to hang a scrap tag on any being. They'd much rather hang a rework tag. See if we can grind this one to fit. Let's salvage. And then they again appeal to the father-son relationship. And then they admonish, number four, they admonish the rest of us to say, all right, you're all of the same family. This is your brother. He's put up with some things in return for the benefit which you receive through family membership. And then number five, Michael didn't have the authority anyway. And number six, the ancients of days did, but they wouldn't overrule Michael, the creator's son. And number seven, Emmanuel counseled Michael to stay out of this. And when you deal with a counsel offered by a union of days, this is the counsel of the Paradise Trinity. This is the counsel of justice, not just mercy. And number eight, the next higher echelon of authority, the next lower echelon, the faithful of days, also of Trinity origin, subject to the Constellation Fathers, don't get arbitrary. Don't land the Marines. Just let this thing work itself out. You see why? Free will choice is the challenge. You monkey around with free will choice, even with good intentions, and you're monkeying around with God's will in the universe. Leave it alone. Better you box the nose off barehanded. Down on Jerusalem, it speaks of the personal representative of the Supreme Executive of Ravantan. I think he must be the assigned temple down there. He's listed among the higher personalities of the infinite spirit. And he really speaks for pretty high authority in time and space. If you think of the ancients of days as the triune president of the super universe, the Supreme Executive is the chairman of the board. This is his personal representative. Reports directly. And this individual said, if you try to suppress this rebellion, here's what may happen. Nobody from this area will have a chance to reach paradise. We'll have to quarantine this area because they won't have made a choice. And again, we don't want any tangling. We didn't start this thing, but since it started, these people are going to have to choose now. You know, it's all down here in this world. When Caligastia raised the issue, they isolated the planet very shortly. And until the last personality who understood the issue had made his choice, they left this planet to do its own due. Not until the last being had chosen did the Varanadek sun arrive and trip Caligastia in his shoulder strap and take the titular authority away from him. For 7 years, he could defy anybody. And finally, everybody had chosen sides. Then they came down and decommissioned him as planetary prince. Said a while ago, it was a higher personality of the infinite. What?
One of the higher personalities of the infinite spirit, of origin of the infinite spirit. You want to know down? I'll tell you where they discussed it. And he is discussed on page 268, assigned sentinel. And then Michael associates, created associates, issued her third independent proclamation. It's much better to play it this way, even if it took a million years to wind the thing up. And number 12, to me, is the most, one of the most interesting statements in this book. It's from the 12th reason for the wisdom of delay that I calculated the age of Arvanda, because you can set up a proportion. This is where I get my math. What they're doing is they're pointing out the relativity of time. Now, they're not discussing the Einsteinian concept that time is a function of velocity through space. The best way I can read them here is to say that what this means to me is subjective time. My day has 24 hours in it, just like it always has. When I was in grammar school, let's take fourth grade, and school let out in June, and I had summer vacation ahead of me. I had a small slice of eternity ahead. Do you check me on this in your own experience? All right. Is 3 months very long now? I would say that I have a feeling now that I think about 3 or 4 years, like I used to think about 3 or 4 months. My seniors tell me that this is more so the longer we live. I think if we look at this statement this way, we'll feel it more. They simply say, sure, we've been taking 200,000 years. We just now got the case wrong. And we may take another 100,000 years. They say, now, all right, you may think this is a long time, but how would you feel if somebody really put this Earth on its ear, committed some terrible planetary crime, and within 3 days you apprehended him, tried him, and executed him? They said, that would be about in proportion. That would be about in proportion. Comparing your life with Lucifer's life. And they said, in terms of universal, it's near 2.5 seconds. And in terms of paradise, the execution took place simultaneously with the commitment of the crime. All right, let's take a look and see what this means. Let me just take you through a few things. On paper 392, it says, page 392, after the creation of the Brahmadek, and they followed the Melchizedek, the Creator Son and the Universe Mother Spirit unite for the purpose of bringing into existence the third order of universe friendship, the Lamanadek. The universe of Nebadon began its existence with exactly 12 million Lamanadek. In other words, they were all created at about the same time, right? Because they went to school, and the Melchizedek classified them based on attainment, primary, secondary, and tertiary. They haven't created any more Lamanadek. All right, how old were these Lamanadek? Well, we can get some light on that one, too. No, people mean the way they cut away their stuff all over the paper. Turn to page 653. They're discussing the origin of the Andromeda Nebula, which gave birth to our sun. Have you got 653? Look down at the last paragraph on that page. This paragraph is captioned 400 billion years ago. Don't bother reading. Turn over to the next page. Yes, it was scarcely a million years subsequent to this epoch that Michael of Nebadon, the creator son of paradise, selected this disintegrating nebula as the site of his adventure in universe building. That's when Michael arrived out here. read down a couple of paragraphs to the paragraph which says 200 billion years ago. Read the last sentence in that paragraph. The oldest inhabited planets of Nebadon came from these times. Now, we don't know how old Lucifer is, but we can put limits on his age. He is less than 400 billion years old. He is more than 200 billion years old. Because they just aren't about to have planets. It's only got planetary princes and system sovereigns, right?
Well, I don't know how much information you are wearing, but I have a note on it 300 million years ago, about the time of
Atlantis,
that's
for sure. That's my guess. I have no reason to skew this one way or another, so I just say, what's the difference? So, in human life, seven years, compared to 300 billion. Of course, you can work out a nice proportion. You can compare Lucifer's life on a 3-day basis to X on a 2.5-second basis. And you can estimate the age of Obama, which he figured out is around 40,000 billions of years, right? I don't know if it's a goal. Yeah. You can see 40,000, 40 million, because that's what we're trying to work. It's a gazillion years old. Well, I would say that to a, I'll take the shortest life people on the planet, they're secondary midwives. They're about 37,000 years old. I would say that to a secondary midwife, no human being would be reckoned as having any age whatsoever. It's all too quick. I would say that from the perspective of a secondary midwife, we look to them as though we passed out, stretch our wings, dry out, and move on. Just about that fast. They're pretty old, too.
Yeah, but they have to live it.
I know.
Live it by minute, maybe.
The super universes were started simultaneously, but the local universes have been stretched out over a half a long time. They've been commissioning them only as nebula just started. My ship couldn't come out here in time and space until we had something physical to work with. You don't think they're in heaven? Oh, no. No. For example, my field number is 600,000.
It's more than I thought, anyway.
611,121. Well, that means to me that when he was commissioned, there were almost 90,000 creator sons that hadn't been commissioned yet. There's only 700,000 local universes. That's 100,000. And then they discussed the payoff, the triumph of love. Incidentally, he said, I've given you 12 reasons. And he said, there are 12 more that make sense to me that I can't put names on. Which means you know the 24. And then he goes on to say, I don't doubt 1 minute that what there's an equal number that I don't realize. There's humility. They go on to say, there are something to them. Number one, if you've been put through the mill, we're going to take 619. If you've been put through the mill, you may have to do a lot of paying from a temporal standpoint, but not spiritually.